Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and the Dow is down this morning. It's the first day of trading, of course, after the decision Friday by Standard & Poor's to downgrade the United States' long-term debt, dropping it from AAA to AA+. This followed a roller coaster of a ride on Friday with stocks knocked down and then dragging themselves up through trading, closing flat in the end, but capping the worst weekly decline since November 2006. And the market swung more than 400 points on Friday as nervous investors were shaken by the news about a weak U.S. economy and Europe's debt problems. The downgrade by S&P is likely to ensure that nervousness will continue this week. Joining me now is Diane Brady. She is senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. And if you have calls for Diane Brady about the S&P downgrade and what it will mean for the U.S. economy or the world markets, please call us 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. So, Diane, first things first, I want to check in with our reporter on the floor at this hour, Ilya Marets. And as we know, the markets have just opened, and Ilya is with us from the street, as we call it here in New York. Ilya, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Jamie.
All right. What's the reaction there on Wall Street at this hour?
Well, the two traders I spoke with both said, you know, more or less, we knew that there was going to be a sharp decline right at the opening bell because pre-market trading was indicating that, and some of the Asian and Middle Eastern markets were indicating that. But right now, volume is actually pretty light. The Dow is down around 200 points, and they both said that their investors are kind of taking a wait-and-see approach. They know that this is bad news, but they don't know whether the reaction is really going to carry further than a day or 2 days.
And you're talking to traders there on the floor. Are the numbers today specific to the S&P downgrade?
Well, absolutely, but there's a lot of other stuff that's happening as well. As you know, over the weekend, the European Central Bank intervened to help Italy and Spain buying bonds, government bonds in those countries. And one of the traders I spoke with said he's actually a lot more worried about what's going on in Europe. He sees a lot more potential for that to disrupt things. After all, the S&P downgrade, you kind of knew was coming. They had issued a warning, I think, perhaps 6 weeks ago, that they were considering a downgrade. Mm-hmm. So it was news, but it wasn't news that you didn't expect. Whereas what's happening in Europe, it really seems to change from day to day, week to week. And so far, policymakers' response has been inadequate.
I want to ask Diane Brady about that little bit of a heads up we may have had in advance of this news. But one last question for you, Ilya. What about the Asian markets and other markets overseas? I read early this morning that the initial shock waves from the downgrade of the government's credit rating were felt in stock markets. In Asia, had slipped by midday, I guess it was, because, of course, they're way ahead of us on the clock. Is that consistent with what you're hearing?
They're way ahead of us on the clock. They also, some Asian countries also own a lot of U.S. government debt, so they have particular reason to be concerned. Mm. Speaking of China and Japan, of course, I don't know where they stand right now. I can't tell you, but I do know one trader who I spoke with was talking about the Tel Aviv exchange, and he felt that the Tel Aviv exchange had sort of way overreacted. And I think there's a little bit of a sense that the rest of the world got to process this first. And now that American stock traders are processing it, maybe the market's reaction will be a little bit more muted.
All right. Ilya Marets, thank you very much for that reporting from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. We will continue to check in with you throughout the day.
Thanks, Jamie.
All right. So now we turn to Diane Brady, again, senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, thank you for joining us on WNYC.
Nice to be here.
And you hear that important context. Always good to have the news of the moment when we talk about the larger news, which really came down late Friday. And this is radio, which gives us the luxury of a deep breath and time for a little analysis. Some of our listeners have been immersed in this story since the news broke on Friday. But for those who haven't, Diane, and perhaps even for those who have, let's break it down a little bit. What exactly does it mean when we say that Standard and Poor's has downgraded the U.S.? First of all, who are Standard and Poor's? And what does it mean to say that they've downgraded our long-term debt, dropping us from a AAA to a AA+?
Well, you know, you raise a good point. Standard and Poor's is a credit rating agency, one of the vilified credit rating agencies that slapped AAA on some of that dubious debt that caused the mortgage crisis. But basically, it is. There's also Fitch and Moody's, but S&P is the one that came out first and has said that the U.S. is no longer the safest place to park your money. The AAA is basically saying there is no safer place in the world. Now, a couple of other countries have that. So now we are below countries like Germany, basically, and saying if you're going to park your money, this might not be the safest place to do it. What's significant about this is it's the first downgrade in history, and I think that that's what has people spooked. We've had problems for a long time, but there's never been any question about the U.S. government paying its bills. So a lot of people see this as a political move, but basically I think what it says is that, you know, S&P and the rest of the world no longer looks at us as the safest place, and it could and probably will affect the borrowing costs, not just for the government, but also for Americans themselves.
For individuals, and I want to talk specifically about that in a moment, but we have an early caller with a specific question. Gerhardt here in Manhattan has a question for you, Diane. Please go ahead. You're on WMYC, Gerhardt, with Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek.
Hello. I'm wondering, who are the major shareholders of McGraw-Hill S&P, and could there be a political side to this downgrade?
Please go ahead, Diane. We're going to talk a lot more about politics in our next segment, but please answer the question. And I'm curious about the first part of that question as well. Who are the shareholders?
Well, you know, obviously the McGraw family owns 4%. In fact, they're in the news right now because they're activist investors that are in McGraw-Hill calling for a breakup of the company. We used to be owned by McGraw-Hill. Obviously, we're not anymore. We're part of Bloomberg. But I think that rather than ask about who the shareholders are in McGraw-Hill, I think it's a pretty wide range of shareholders. S&P is supposed to be neutral insofar as they're supposed to go out and simply look at debt, look at sort of an investment on its own merits. But I think the caller raises a good point. Gerhardt, you're talking about whether there's a political motivation. There certainly has been a lot of criticism of the credit rating agencies because they've said certain investments were wonderful that turned out to go belly up, and then now they're saying the U.S. government is AAA. It is an opinion, obviously. We have Bill Gross, who's the head of the world's largest bond fund, giving it a thumbs up, but Warren Buffett came out today and said the U.S. government deserves a quadruple A, so he completely disagrees with S&P.
Now, to be clear on what this means, getting back to my basic question, this is about Treasury bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds. It has nothing to do with stocks, isn't that right?
It is about Treasury bonds, but it's also they're also looking at other government-related investments. What it does, though, is it raises the borrowing costs for the government, and that's important because we all know that those borrowing costs have been a problem. We've all lived through the debates about raising the debt ceiling, and I think what it does is it also, I think the biggest fear people have is that it may tip the U.S. again into a recession, and that's what has people spooked about stocks. So, no, I mean, GE's borrowing costs obviously have nothing to do with the U.S. government's borrowing costs, but if it's more expensive for the government to borrow, if there's less confidence in the economy, that affects our companies, and it certainly affects their ability to make money.
What about rumors, Diane, that Standard & Poor's is going to downgrade other countries this week? Are you hearing anything on that, and what would the effect of that be?
Well, all eyes are on Europe, and we've been watching this very, sad and drawn-out domino effect. Obviously, they've looked at Greece, they've looked at Portugal. The ones that are in the news right now are Spain and Italy. Very, very high levels of debt, and one of the problems with a downgrade is that does raise your borrowing costs. So if you owe 120% of what you take in, well, that might be sustainable at, say, 3-4%, but if suddenly it goes up a percentage point, then you can't pay your bills, and that's been one of the big concerns. So they're looking at Europe, and specifically the concerns right now are Italy and Spain, which are much, much bigger than Portugal and Greece and could really have a traumatic effect on Europe.
Let's take a call from Nick. He is in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Nick, please go ahead. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. Just to pick up on some of the other stuff, it's clear that Standard & Poor's has done this before. They've been totally wrong. And the way they've been wrong accrued to the benefit of the big money, of the derivative people, of the market manipulators and the hedge funds. And they're doing it all over again. And what's happening is that ordinary people who invest in the stock market from money that they earned through making a living are panicking, are being steamrolled and scared to death and selling when there's no real reason to. And who profits from this? The people who profit from volatility. The point I'm making is there are all kinds of perverse motives that are essentially corrupt. This may be legal, but it's really evil and corrupt and dirty, and they're getting away with it again.
Now, Nick, they've not downgraded the United States before because the U.S. has never been downgraded before. You mean they've downgraded other institutions?
No, they've upgraded to AAA level bonds that were essentially junk bonds that were crap. And when I say they've done this before, I mean that what they've done before is they've been totally 180 degrees wrong, and they were wrong in a direction that made the rich much richer and made ordinary investors much poorer. That's the pattern that I see here.
So you
ordinary
suggest
investors are constantly being stampeded by fear, the gold bugs, the hedge funds, the volatility machine traders, they all profit from fear. So you've got a cash flow, a multi-trillion-dollar cash flow that benefits from fear. That turns into PR, that turns into action, that turns into pressure on reporting agencies.
Well, Nick raises you raise a very good point, Nick, in that we have seen and heard from S&P and the other credit rating agencies during this financial drama before, and that was because they did put AAA on a lot of these mortgage-backed securities, which basically they didn't look at correctly. They didn't value it correctly. They didn't do their due diligence, and as a result,
were they incompetent or corrupt?
I think what happened was, they gave their own explanation, but there's no question that those securities did not deserve a AAA, and there's no question that people come out and disagree with, what S&P or Fitch or Moody's say. The problem is that even if it's considered subjective, those credit ratings are used as a basis for borrowing costs. They're used as a basis for who can invest and how you can invest. So they have a very real impact, even if we disagree with, whether or not they're valid.
Now, Diane, and I want to thank Nick very much for his call, and I also want to be sure to thank our earlier caller as well, Gerhard, who had called in from Manhattan. Diane, I have to ask a question about the baseline, because essentially the United States was the baseline here, and it seems as though now we're redefining the baseline. Isn't that what S&P has done, and what does it mean essentially to redefine that baseline?
We've always been seen as, first of all, the reserve currency for the world.
Yes.
We've always been seen as the safest market. So, yes, it does say that, this is no longer, in their eyes, the safest place to be. But the reality is that we're in such a volatile climate right now that you can say, well, I may be ugly, but look at that guy over there, specifically in Europe, and he or she looks a lot uglier. And the reality is Europe's been looking pretty ugly. People are very worried about China for multiple reasons, whether it's a bubble, whether you quite, understand the markets there. So there haven't been a lot of other places to put your money. So I think the U.S. is still, haven't seen the dollar really implode as a result of this, although the dollar has been dropping. It's still seen as the safest place to put your money. But the reality is people are more nervous. S&P is certainly coming out and saying we don't deserve the top grade. And it's one reason why gold has hit 1700 and rising. People are trying to put their money somewhere, anywhere that feels safe.
I want to bring into our conversation, Diane, Jacob Goldstein. He is part of the Planet Money team at National Public Radio. And Jacob, welcome to WNYC here in New York.
Hi, good morning.
I came across in my reading on this in preparation your piece at NPR.org, and I commend anyone who's interested in the topic to take a look at that. And it has a very interesting headline, Why S&P's Downgrade of the U.S. Credit Rating May Not Be as Bad as Everyone Seems to Think. So why not, Jacob?
Well, basically, S&P is not telling the world anything new about the United States government and its ability or willingness to pay off its debt. I mean, I think that's really key. It's their opinion. They lay out their reasons for their opinion. It shouldn't be surprising to anyone. Furthermore, most Treasury debt is held by great big institutions that have lots of money and that do their own research, and we're already well aware of everything S&P is laying out. I mean, there are some instances where a rating matters in a kind of mechanical way, where if there's a downgrade, then for various reasons such as regulation or the internal rules at a financial group, they're forced to sell. But in the case of this rating, from AAA to AA+, that does not seem to be the case, so we won't see any forced selling. So, you know, there's no kind of technical reason, there's nothing new here that would suggest that this is going to make everybody say, oh, wow, U.S. debt is much riskier than we thought. I mean, the one effect it may have, it certainly got huge headlines over the weekend. It has this very powerful kind of narrative feel to it, right? It's a story. The headline itself is a thing.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that it does matter, I think it's simply, to what extent does it contribute really to the fear and to this narrative of the decline of the American economy in the world?
Diane, what's your take on that?
I think it's true that we've known about the fundamental problems of the U.S. economy for some time, obviously, and the borrowing costs of the U.S. government have been pretty good, even in light of that. But I think that what makes this significant in part is it follows this ongoing game of chicken that we saw take place in Washington, and the idea that the U.S. actually would consider not paying its bills, that it would rather be a deadbeat than raise the debt ceiling. I think that had people spooked, and I think that clearly was a factor here in downgrading. And what it does is, you're right. The grade, you may know that you're going to be getting a lower grade. You haven't been doing your homework. You haven't been doing what you have to do. But when you get it, it's still a shock. And I think it also is an official stamp that puts us below some of our peers. And we've never been there. We're used to being number one. Now we're not.
And that's not entirely inconsistent, Jacob, with your point.
No, I mean, look, it is powerful in a narrative sense. Although, I mean, I can't, and I'm generally wary of talking about one-day market moves, but I can't resist this morning pointing out the fact that Treasury yields are actually down. So that is, you know, the interest rate that the government has to pay to borrow money is lower right now than it was on Friday. And, you know, there's this strange story I've heard people tell about this morning, which is, S&P downgraded U.S. government debt. That made investors get scared. And what investors do when they get scared is buy U.S. government debt. But, like, when people tell that story, they sort of laugh, right? How can you tell that story with a straight face? I think there are much broader, real economic worries that are, you know, more substantive, frankly, than the downgrade. Even the GDP numbers that came out a week ago, they sort of got buried in the debt ceiling debate. But it was this really bad report about U.S. economic growth. Like, that is a big deal. That is something that would make you be scared about the economy and sell stocks and buy treasuries. What's going on in Europe is scary. I mean, I think in many ways, even though they're sort of more complicated or more nerdy or more boring and don't have the narrative heft, there are lots of good reasons to be scared about the economy right now.
Well, and much of that has to do with how these stories are reported, why they are reported. As you suggest, Jacob, the narrative may be more compelling, how much or how well the reporters understand the stories.
No, I mean, I don't want to run down any reporters. I just think there is a real you know, we are creatures of narrative, right? And when something like this happens that is so has this symbolic resonance, and it fits into a broader narrative. That is a broader narrative for good reason, right? That the U.S. over the long term probably will become less of the dominant player in the global economy. This may be one small step in that much broader story, right? I mean, I don't mean to be entirely dismissive.
Or it may not. I guess that remains to be seen. Jacob, I want to thank you. I do want to commend your piece to those who are listening. Again, why S&P's downgrade of the U.S. credit rating may not be as bad as it sounds. That's Planet Money team. Jacob Goldstein is with us, and he joined us. He's with NPR's Planet Money. And Diane Brady is going to stay with us. We're going to take a turn on this subject, talk a little more about politics and policy. And, yes, we will talk about the media, Jacob, so you may want to keep listening. But we won't run down any reporters. Don't worry.
I think there's been a lot of really good coverage.
Can we just say that? I do, too. I'm Jamie Floyd. I'm in for Brian Lehrer. Stay with us. Lots more on this coming right up.
We haven't been able to get the kind of compromise because our partners on the other side of the aisle have been unwilling to reform the programs that are the cause of our future debt problem.
I think it's failed presidential leadership when you don't put forward a plan, a specific proposal.
The fact of the matter is that this is essentially a Tea Party downgrade. The Tea Party brought us to the brink of a default.
This is the Tea Party downgrade because a minority of people in the House of Representatives countered even the will of many Republicans in the United States Senate.
That's the blame game that went on yesterday on the Sunday talk shows in Washington, D.C. You heard there Paul Ryan on Fox News Sunday, Senator John McCain on NBC's Meet the Press, David Axelrod on CBS's Face the Nation, and John Kerry on NBC's Meet the Press. And everybody was talking, of course, about Standard & Poor's downgrade of the U.S.'s long-term debt, dropping from AAA to AA+ for the first time ever. But as you heard, no one wanted to take responsibility for what has happened. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. We are talking about the market reaction today to the news of Standard & Poor's downgrade. And we are talking with my guest, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek. We are joined now also by William Salatin, who is with Slate. He has written a piece called Revenge of the Middle, the S&P downgrade, which is the beginning of the end of the left-right war. Both sides will lose, he suggests. William, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So why do you see it as the beginning of the end of the left-right war?
Well, because a third constituency that is not the hardline anti-tax right or the hardline anti-entitlement cuts left is now speaking up, and it is the bondholders and the credit markets, and basically saying we cannot go on having this political fight between people who refuse to accept one or both of those alternatives. We're going to have to do both of them because our debt is so out of control. Something along the lines of what President Obama was talking about with that grand bargain is going to happen whether we like it or not, because there's no other way to get control of our debt and thereby secure the confidence of the credit markets.
All right. Well, we are happy to hear from our callers on this. Who do you blame? The Obama administration for a lack of leadership? The Tea Party for a lack of flexibility? Of course, we're always searching for the middle here on the Brian Lehrer Show. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or post a comment at WNYC.org. Or do you simply not care that much what Standard & Poor's says about the U.S. credit rating? 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And we are talking now about the politics of this story because, William, at bottom, that's what this really was, a political decision. Standard & Poor's, and this was an unusual conference call with reporters. They don't usually do this, but they insisted that they hadn't overstepped and had focused on, quote, the political paralysis in Washington as much as fiscal policy in determining the new rating. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, their rating is based, as they explained it in their written outline and in the conference call, it's a two-step process. Number one, the math doesn't add up. They're saying the debt is running out of control. We are not sufficiently cutting spending or increasing taxes to get that under control. Secondly, even if the math is a little better than they originally estimated, which is the argument of the Obama administration, Standard & Poor's is saying that the political system is broken. That is, the two parties, each one has some leverage in the political process that can prevent a resolution, and they are failing to come to agreement on a strategy, either raising revenues, cutting spending, or both, that will get the debt under control. So we don't have the political system in place to get a plan that will make the math work.
And Diane Brady, it does all go back, and you touched on this in our last segment, all go back to the debt ceiling. And S&P said, quote, "The debacle over the debt ceiling continued until almost the midnight hour. Fiscal policy, like other government policy, is fundamentally a political process," end quote. Diane, that's true, but who's to blame for that? The debt ceiling debate goes around in every administration. I know that. I worked in the Clinton administration. That's nothing new. There was a debt ceiling debate during the Bush years. It just became a political football this time around.
Well, and it obviously rarely becomes this high profile, certainly not to the last minute. And it's worth noting for listeners that I think Denmark is the only other Western nation that even has a debt ceiling. I mean, what a debt ceiling is basically raising your credit limit to pay the bills you've already said you're going to pay. So it becomes an excuse to shovel in every other agenda item you have, and so we were debating macro issues like basically Social Security with hours to spare. So what the right thing to do should have been raise the debt ceiling and, of course, you know, debate these fundamental issues that, you know, whether we address them or not would lead to a downgrade. The problem is that we basically told the world we were going to let politics trump over being the best place to do business, and S&P raised that point, and certainly we heard many other countries, including the all-important China, come out and say this is ridiculous, get your act together.
Let's take a call from Rick in Englewood, New Jersey. Rick, you are on WMYC.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm really interested in why we have to sit back and watch government officials who are supposed to be elected to represent the people, many of whom, 261 to be exact, are multimillionaires, why they are driving up their wealth. They are affecting the financial markets of the world, and they are keeping down the middle class and the lower class by manipulating the system using excuses like the debt ceiling. They are taking politics, and they're making a game out of it, and we're the people that suffer.
It sounds as though you blame everyone.
I don't blame everyone, but I blame the politicians specifically because I voted. I'm a progressive Democrat. I voted for Obama. I know there are people that are Republicans that probably feel the same way I do. There are many middle-class people that voted Republican. There are lower economically driven people who voted Republican, but in essence, they're supposed to be representing us and doing what's best for us. And right now, what they're doing is they're playing with the system. As I said, there's 261 members of Congress that are millionaires or greater. Their wealth is growing. Our ability to live is going downward, while their growth rate is in double digits.
And
so, I mean, how am I supposed to succeed when they're pushing us down?
Rather than acting in your best interest. Thank you, Rick, very much for your call. And William Salatin, your piece suggests that this may be the big wake-up call that they need.
Yeah, I disagree that this is a game. In fact, I think the problem, at least with the Tea Party Republicans, is not their wealth. It's their sincerity, their passion, their ideology about getting debt under control. And it comes back to the point that Diane was just making. So they wanted to get the budget under control, fine, but they picked the debt ceiling as their occasion. That's the moment when they thought, we have leverage, we're going to use this. And the message from S&P is, you do not use the debt ceiling, which is, as Diane pointed out, is to pay past commitments as the occasion for this fight, because now you're messing not with, you know, what we're going to spend on, but whether we're going to pay bills to the people we promised, and those people are not happy.
But William, is S&P's Standard & Poor's action really likely to force some sort of consensus on what is really a fundamental divide in this country over spending and taxes? We're already hearing what we heard at the beginning of this segment, in fact, are the politicians on both sides using this decision to stake out those same old positions.
Oh, yeah. No, Standard & Poor's rating by itself will not change anything. It's a symptom of what's going on. And the symptom is the obvious loss of the objective basis for confidence in the U.S. having a AAA credit rating. And eventually, if there are further downgrades, which is the current trend, and as interest rates go up, that's what will really do the talking. When interest rates go up, then politicians will be increasingly forced to act.
All right.
And what
oh,
you know,
ahead,
one
Diane.
Thing we've done is we have been very much relying on the kindness of our neighbors. We owe a lot, you know, a lot of the IOUs, for example, are to China. If they start to sour on the idea of buying U.S. debt and look elsewhere and diversify, that's also going to be a problem for us because we have to big bills to pay internally. So ultimately, the feeling is yes, taxes will go up, yes, spending will go down. How we get there could be a very messy process, but
yes.
There's no question that the current scenario is unsustainable. Everybody knows that.
And there was that big piece, of course, in the Times a couple of days ago. China tells the U.S. it must cure its addiction to debt. Let's take a call from Kim in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Hi.
Kim, you're on WMYC.
I totally blame the Tea Party. I'm really tired of this myth of it's both parties, both sides are, you know, intransigent and won't, you know, won't meet in the middle. I mean, I'm sorry, but we've seen from our president, he's gone over to the right, and these people, they won't take anything but only their way.
And Kim, you don't blame the administration at all for any of this.
I don't see that the administration, if anything, I think the administration, well, I would have liked to have seen them try to hold firmer, but I didn't see that was really possible. I mean, the other side was saying, we will go into the abyss. We will make sure, we don't care. We won't pay our bills. So I'm really just frustrated with the way the media keeps playing this as both sides. It's just equally. I think Paul Krugman just did an. I think he was the one who wrote an opinion piece about that, and how what it does is it keeps moving everything. It keeps moving it to the right, so that if one side is extreme. Very extreme in their positions, as the Tea Party is, and the other side is just pretty moderate. To meet in the middle, you have to go over to, you know, closer to that extreme side, and that's what we're seeing happening.
Thank you, Kim, very much for your call, and we appreciate your taking the time to call in. One consistent theme from all the callers this morning has been a sense of frustration, whatever their point of view. William, is there any truth in what the White House and the Treasury say that S&P did not factor in the just enacted deal for increasing the debt limit, that the timing of this is just a bit odd?
Well, S&P had issued a warning about that. I mean, they were working on this for 3 months, and they were talking to Treasury, and there was a lot of back and forth. There's a dispute about technical assumptions that were in the calculation. But the warning was issued earlier, and the interesting question is how much of the S&P decision was based on the math, and how much of it was based on the political judgment that our system was broken. I think it was mostly the latter. And therefore, when the numbers didn't quite add up the way they thought, they stuck with the conclusion. It does raise the question, how competent is S&P to judge a political system as opposed to economic factors?
And Diane, I do want to talk a little bit about something that the caller raised, which is the role of the media in all of this, because we do have a responsibility to report the news as the news and tell stories where appropriate. But we also have a responsibility not to create a story where there may, in fact, be no story. Some suggested we may have done that with the debt ceiling debate. So help us out here. How significant is this story today? In the end, I mean, how significant will it prove over time as a practical matter in the real world for the markets over time and for real people on the ground?
I think that the story of the downgrade itself will play out over the next few weeks, but it's emblematic of a larger story that we're going to be covering for some time. And clearly, you know, the economy is going to be the number one issue going into the election. So I think as the media, we have a responsibility, as the caller said, number one, to name who the villains are. I think the House Republicans did come out looking the worst from the debt ceiling debate. But I think also over time, we have to look more closely at the administration and the degree to which it, at least initially, alienated business and vilified business and, you know, has put in place the types of incentives to encourage business to hire to get the economy starting again. So, you know, I think this particular story is just going to be a chapter in a much larger tale, but it's a tale that is going to basically about getting our house in order and getting this economy growing again. And I think that both sides have a role to play in that.
Well, thanks to you both. Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Business Week. And you can read William Salatin's piece on this very topic, Revenge of the Middle, the S&P downgrade, is the beginning of the end of the left-right war, we can only hope. And both sides will lose. That's at Slate. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, facial recognition in the war on crime. Stay with us.